different cases, both of which happen to involve oil companies, which is sort of a coming together of things. The first is on the docket is Valerio Diamond versus B&D 6. Parties are present. Counselor at table. Is that set up? The second one is Equity Oil Company versus Atlantic Richfield. Counsel present in that case? Both sides. Thank you. Let me make a brief record before we start argument. Each case is set for 15 minutes per side. There is a clock that keeps track of the time that's operated by the bailiff. There's a module on the lectern to keep you advised of how much time is remaining. In addition, there are lights, green, yellow, or orange, and red that tell you the stage of the argument. The green is on for the first 10 minutes, the yellow for the next five, and the red when the argument is over. We would advise you that we've all read the briefs. We've all read some of the authority cited in the brief. One of us has been into the record to some considerable extent. So we perceive that we understand the facts as set forth in the briefs and the general thrust of the authority set forth in the briefs. You may use your time any way you wish, but we would recommend that you devote most of your time to legal issues and not with the facts. If the appellant wishes to reserve time for rebuttal, the module will tell you how much time you have left, and you can stop anytime you wish. But if you want me to assist you in some manner, I'll be happy to give you a high sign or wave at you or do something to tell you when you've reached the amount of time you say you want to reserve. The lectern is adjustable for height. There are toggle switches on your right for that purpose. You may feel free to adjust it when you get there to make sure that you're totally comfortable with it. There is a microphone on the lectern that accomplishes two things. One, it amplifies the sound in the room so everyone can hear what you're saying. And it also records the argument or is attached to a recorder, which does so. We sometimes use the recordings in the course of preparing an opinion, and we would appreciate it if you would stay at or near, very near the lectern so that the microphone can clearly pick up your voice, lest we go back and listen to it. And finally, we would ask anyone who has an electronic device that makes noise at unexpected times and sometimes inopportune times to please turn it off, put it on silent, or otherwise enable it, disable it, so that it will not disturb counsel or the court in what we call an argument, but I think might be more accurately described as a conversation. That is to say, we will be asking questions and counsel will be answering and the discussion will ensue. Now, we don't wish to be disturbed in that process. If there are no questions concerning how we're going to proceed, we are ready to proceed with Valerio versus B&D, and if you wish to save rebuttal time, please let me know.
May it please the court, counsel.
Before we start the clock, there are motions for stay pending. We've gotten a motion filed and a motion and a response to that motion. I'd like to take maybe a minute to give each of you a minute to, if there's any further information that we need to know before we rule on that motion, we'd like to have it now.
In advance of the oral argument?
Yes.
Okay. Actually, I did not come fully prepared to address those issues, but what I can say, in addition to the information that we've provided in our papers, I know there's been a challenge to the fact that we did not raise this issue with the trial court in the first instance, and the point to be made there is that my client made a decision not initially to pursue a stay as a consequence of the potential of having to post a bond as we got closer to the time for oral argument, and in light of the short amount of time, frankly, between when the documents were submitted for signature and execution to carry forward on the judgment and the amount of time before one would anticipate that a decision would be rendered. At that point, my client concluded that it made more sense, and the potential prejudice was substantially greater to him under those circumstances, because he could avoid the irreparable harm if he were to seek the stay. And at this late hour, we concluded that this court was the appropriate place to pursue it, because of the extended period of time now that has lapsed since the trial court heard this case, and the fact
that at the time the court ruled, there, first of all, there was an issue about a temporary building. Has a temporary building been installed?
It has.
Okay. The second was the issue of a set of plans that were existent at the time the court entered its order. And then I understand there have been one or two more sets of plans. Is that correct?
Well, as I understand it from the pleadings, that's correct. But what we have seen are effectively two sets of plans. We knew they were working on a second set of plans after the order was entered, and my client signed the documents back at the time that the order was entered, back in 2008. What had transpired that we learned about in the papers is that they had, Blair had decided to increase the size and magnitude of the project once they learned from the court that they could build anything that they could put to a lawful business purpose. And so they were expanding their plans. Then the economic downturn hit and they made a revision apparently, and that's what's taken the extended period of time for them to come forward.
And that's what's pending now. This is the new set. Do you have anything you wish to add?
Yes, sir.
Pardon? Please take the lectern so we can.
Thank you. Your Honor, Michael Sullivan on behalf of Valero Diamond Metro with A. Peter Gregory. It's Valero's position that, one, this should be heard by the trial court, that she's most familiar with the facts involved in this case, which are somewhat complicated, and she's in the best position to formulate the proper amount of the bond. And the bond is necessary. As set forth in our brief, we will suffer more economic damage if we're not able to go forth. The deadline for the viability of the application will pass in August, and this court may not have ruled by then. And even if it does rule, the defendant may seek certiorari. So we'd ask that if the court in the first instance refer this back to the district court for a hearing on the motion to stay, and in the second instance, if the court's inclined to grant their motion, that a sizable bond be entered such that would encompass the potential damage that we will suffer if this case stretches out a number of years and he does not have to sign the pre-application documents. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may proceed with the argument, sir.
Thank you. My name is Ken Skog with the law firm of Lau Feld & Skog, and I represent the defendant below and the appellant here, B&D6 LLC. I'll refer to them throughout the argument today as B&D. And with me at council table is Bill Coyle, who is the principal of B&D. I will refer to Valero Diamond Metro as Valero for shorthand purposes. I do wish to reserve 5 minutes of time for rebuttal, or as close thereto as we can manage. I don't wish to use any of my time imprudently, so I don't want to go into the facts in too much depth, but the key and cornerstone issue in this case is in the commercial lease, Section 5. And Section 5 of the lease provides two distinct rights to the tenant. The first right is to construct certain and very specific improvements on the property. At the time that the lease was entered into in 1967, the property was vacant land. And the lease provided to the tenant the opportunity to construct improvements on the property. So that's the first right that is granted to the tenant under Section 5. The second is that once the improvements are constructed, that the tenant has the right to use those improvements consistent with the construction of the improvements as a Stuckey's, pecan shop restaurant, and gasoline station, or any other lawful business purpose. Now, those two rights are distinct, both in the law and in the lease. And the reason that that becomes so important, as the court is aware, is that in 2005, The original improvements that had been constructed pursuant to Section 5 were destroyed by fire, and this lease did not have a specific casualty provision that we see in most commercial leases today. And as a consequence of that, there is no granted right in the tenant to reconstruct the premises. There's no.
So when the construction clause portion of the lease, when the original Stuckey's was built, then the construction clause was fulfilled and no longer had a role or anything to be interpreted in the lease after that? Is that your position then?
It's our position that that took care of in terms of what was constructed on the property. And the construction right that had been granted to the tenant had been fully exercised, yes. Now, we did not take the position in the trial court below. I was not involved in the trial, but I have read the record, and I know that, in fact, there was no contention in the trial court by B&D that the tenant had absolutely no right to reconstruct. But what the tenant said under the circumstances, or what B&D said under the circumstances was, if anything is going to be reconstructed, it has to be reconstructed in the consistent with the construction language in Section 5. That is to say, if you're going to rebuild anything, it has to be rebuilt in accordance with the lease. That is to say that you have to rebuild a Stuckey's in accordance with the lease provisions that says it has to be built in conformance with the plans and specification for a Stuckey's restaurant. And that was not the intent of Valero. Valero intended to build something different. And when Valero presented those plans and that intention to B&D, B&D objected and said, I don't agree with that, and we're not going to proceed on that basis. And at the same time, Valero had been conducting its due diligence with Arapahoe County, and Arapahoe County said, if you're going to reconstruct on the property, there are certain other requirements that have to be met. For instance, a letter of authorization was required by Arapahoe County. And for that, the owner of the property, not the tenant, the owner of the property had to execute certain agreements with the county, obligating the owner of the property, again, not the tenant, the owner of the property to meet certain requirements, that is, landscaping requirements, maintenance requirements, and more importantly, yes.
I finish your thought.
To dedicate property, that is, in fee simple absolute, convey to the county certain property for improvements of the road system, and to provide an easement, various drainage easements. And those were new obligations that were not provided for under the terms of the lease, and therefore.
Now let me ask my.
Sure, of course.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. Suppose they built a Stuckey's pursuant to the original plans, and would the government still have these obligations for the easement and the dedication that you just spoke of? Would those still apply?
It's not clear to me. I don't know. And to the extent that those obligations did apply and do apply, then we don't believe that it would be appropriate to enforce those against B&D under the circumstances, because the original construction, there was rezoning contemplated under the lease, and there were certain requirements that were imposed on the landlord at the time back in 1967. But the landlord knew what those obligations were in 1967, and he undertook those knowingly. To now impose some new obligations, such as conveying property, such as undertaking contractual obligations going forward, that far exceeds anything that the landlord had agreed to undertake.
Mr. Skog, when someone enters into a lease term of 60 years, though, isn't it reasonable to contemplate that there will be things like zoning changes or new regulations that have to be complied with in the event improvements or construction needs to be done?
Well, certainly, but what we're talking about in terms of construction that was allowed under the terms of the lease, it was merely alterations remodel, that kind of thing, and not something that would involve having to convey property and having to commit the owner to long-term obligations that were not contemplated at the time the parties entered into the lease.
Is there anything under the lease that limits the construction of the original Stuckey's building to a one-time construction?
Well, it speaks in terms of the construction occurring before the property gets used, and so I believe it does, in fact, it not expressly, but by implication, refer to a one-time construction right in the tenant. And any other or any other rights to the tenant in that respect are reflected later in the lease when it talks about the ability to, and the obligation, frankly, to maintain and to modify to the extent necessary or required by law.
As I realize there's a dispute about which order applies and what the orders say, but The original summary judgment order, as I recall, says something to the effect that they can build a building that is a Stuckey's or substantially the same as a Stuckey's. Is that correct?
The original order?
The original summary judgment order indicates that they can build a structure that is a Stuckey's or substantially similar to a Stuckey's.
Well, it actually just says, the lease just says a Stuckey's.
I'm talking about the court order.
Right.
The court order permits them to build a building substantially similar to the original Stuckey's. The original court order.
Well, the original court order actually says they can build any convenience store. It actually expands far beyond anything even similar to a Stuckey's. In fact, that's precisely why they modified their plans to go on a much grander scale, is because the court read the use provision, which says can be used for any lawful purpose, and extended that to the construction and said, as long as you can put it to a lawful purpose, you can construct any gas and convenience store on the premises. And that, again, extends far beyond what the parties could have contemplated back in 1967, or that they would have intended under the circumstances. It not only gives a second construction right, it extends that construction right beyond the narrow focus of...
So there are two orders in that regard, though, are there not?
Two orders in...
That have something to say about what they can build.
Well, the second order, after the summary judgment was granted, the second order is directed more, I think, at directing my client B&D in terms of what they have to agree to, because the court specifically went to great lengths to say, I've already decided this issue. And in order to build a Stuckey's, the court says, which is surprising to me, that it was somehow impossible, and therefore the court said that they were entitled to build in accordance with her summary judgment order, which basically says any convenience store. And the concept that building a Stuckey's store was somehow impossible because they couldn't get plans and specifications, the remedy for impossibility of performance is not to write a new provision in the lease and give them rights beyond so that it's no longer impossible. It's forgiveness of their obligations under the terms of the lease. And that's what is baffling about the trial court's decision there, is because if in fact that was the basis for her conclusion, although it comes in a subsequent order, it wasn't in her summary judgment order, that it was somehow impossible, she gave them the wrong remedy. In fact, the remedy that she provided was to, in effect, rewrite the terms of the lease. She effectively went through and, I mean, if you look at this lease, there's an odd proportionality here. By 2010 standards, to limit somebody to construction of a Stuckey's seems incredibly restrictive. But by the same token, to lease 6 acres of property for $100 a month is also incredibly out of today's standards. In fact, there's evidence in the record that market rent would be $14,000 to $16,000 a month for that property. So the court, looking at the rent issue, specifically said in her summary judgment order, there's no provision in the lease that allows for renegotiation of the rental rate. Well, likewise, or similarly, there's no specific right delegated in the lease to the tenant to rebuild the property.
So, Mr. Scott, just to clarify, is your position now on appeal that the tenants have a right to construct a building similar in size and dimensions to the original Stuckey's, or because of the unanticipated obligations that are now imposed by Arapahoe County that they have no right to rebuild at all?
The latter, Your Honor, that to the extent that they are going to rebuild and seek approval from the owner to come in and commit to those additional obligations, that they have to negotiate for.
The fact that that wasn't your position in the court below, does that preclude us from looking at that issue on appeal?
I don't think it does, because the positions are consistent in that under neither scenario should the owner be required to undertake these additional obligations, whether it's for them to build something that's similar to a Stuckey's or a Stuckey's, or whether they're not entitled to rebuild at all. And so I don't believe that there's any inconsistency in those positions whatsoever. If I may, I'd like to reserve.
You may reserve, and we'll give you 5 minutes.
Thank you very much.
The bailiff set the remaining time for the appellant at 5 minutes. Good.
May it please the court. The trial court's decision concerning the construction of the lease should be upheld. It is entirely consistent with Colorado law, and more importantly, the terms of the lease itself, when construed harmoniously, as the rules of construction of contract tell us to do. The idea that this was only a lease that would allow a person to construct one time a Stuckey's pecan shop is ludicrous. What the Section 5 of the lease says is you go and you build the Stuckey's pecan shop, and then you can do any other lawful business on the property. And later on, in the same paragraph, it refers to keeping the leased premises and structures thereon free and clear from all liens, mechanics liens, other such liens, and then it refers to the repair, alteration, or maintenance of such buildings, plural, and structures. Clearly, this is not limiting language that says you can only build, as in some cases where it says you could only use this property for a church. This is commercial property, and the clear intent of the people entering into this lease is that it will be used for 60 years for a commercial venture. And over time, as we cited to various cases, and I believe AMJUR section, over time conditions change and the nature of the use of the land must change, and that's all in furtherance of economic development. What the position being taken by the appellant in this case urges is to condone economic waste. That is, this building burns down and you can't do anything else with this property for the remainder of this long-term lease. That's not a terrible...
Well, counsel, assume for purposes of argument only that we're somewhere between you and the landlord, or the division may be somewhere between you and the landlord, and conclude that you can build a building of the same size and nature as the original building. Where does that leave you?
Well, that leaves us with an inability to ever expand the property if economic times rebound, and for instance, we wanted to add a truck wash section.
Is that what you bargained for? Isn't that what the original tenant, Stuckey's, bargained for?
No, the original tenant, Stuckey's, Your Honor, bargained to do any lawful business on the property after the Stuckey's pecan shop had been erected, and there was a contemplation that there would be structures and buildings, plural, which means that...
But it's your position that the use of the building also permits the construction of any building?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I believe that's a fair reading of a long-term 60-year lease that was entered into at arm's length between the predecessors to the parties here in front of you today. And of course, you've already heard about the $100 a month rental, which seems to have driven this case. But the record was clear that the appellant knew of that when it purchased the property, knew of the terms, knew the fact that this had not been a Stuckey's pecan shop for years. It had been operated as a Roadrunner station, a Total station, and finally a Diamond Share Market.
But all within the confines of the original building.
All within the confines of the original building as far as we know. Certainly during that time there were repairs that had to be made, and any of the repairs that were made had to comply with the existing code. There was also as to this issue of having to give up property. Certainly the record does not support that. It was testified to by the Arapaho County official who came and spoke that may happen. There was easements that were spoken of, and those perhaps are something that B&D would have to agree to. However, if the lease was terminated today and Mr. Coyle wanted to build on the property, he'd have to agree to all of the same things. So we have a...
Is that the state of the testimony? The state of the testimony, to your understanding, is that if you went back with a set of Stuckey's plans and built that building again, exactly as it was originally built, assuming the code would permit you to, that those same dedications and same procedures would be required?
As to the drainage easement, yes, Your Honor. As to whether or not a portion of the right-of-way in front of the store would have to be conveyed to the county, that is still uncertain and not an issue before this court.
No, but it would be a consideration that would be in play if they rebuilt the same building.
Yes, if anybody did.
And is it also correct, and I have the only document I've seen that the landlord needs to sign is this authorization.
Yeah, I believe there's two, actually, Your Honor.
And I haven't seen any other documents that they may have been called upon to sign, but it appears from that document that it's in the nature of a power of attorney appointing the tenant's developer to sign all documents and make all the conveyances required by the county. Is that your understanding, or what is the nature
no,
of this
not.
Authority?
My understanding is that allows the planning process to go forward. And because we are not the landowner, if we want to get a building permit to rebuild on the property, we're required to have the owner approve that and submit the application. As far as any sort of conveyances that would have to be made, I still believe that they would have to be made by B&D. And I do not believe that what was handed to them to sign, which they were refused to, constituted a power of attorney.
Notarized, so theoretically could be recorded.
That's correct.
And would show authority, some authority. It's not very specific about what the authority is.
The authority was to proceed with the building permit process, as set forth in the affidavits talking that addressed the motion for stay.
Council, I have a question about the reversion of the building back to the landlord.
Yes, sir.
If the original lease called for the construction of a building of certain specifications, and then it was the intent of the parties that at the conclusion of that lease, that building would terminate back to the landlord, would that limit the type of building that could be constructed? Because their intent would be to have a certain type of building revert back, and if by virtue of use the tenants were able to build any sort of building that they wanted, then that would be the building that reverted back to the landlord, and it wouldn't necessarily comply with the intent of the parties.
I believe the intent of the parties would be complied with if the building was of equal value or more value. I would agree that if they left there with no building at all or a burned out building, that would defeat the revisionary interest. But the court brings up a wonderful point, which is the revisionary interest itself supports the idea that the tenant must be allowed to rebuild, because there was an intent of the parties that at the end of the lease, there would be something to reconvey to the landlord.
But rebuild what? What's the extent? How big? Can you rebuild? Can you put a large hotel complex there?
That question is not before the court, because what was proposed was simply just another gas station. It was larger, and now it appears to either be the same size or smaller because of the economic downturn as set forth in the affidavits. I don't believe the court needs to reach the issue of whether or not you can take a lease that was originally for a gas station of a certain square footage and go all the way and say, but that means you could build a casino and a hotel there. I think you could say simply that you must be able to effectuate the intent of the parties to at least have a gas station that incorporates a restaurant and potentially facilities for truckers and all of that. That's what this originally was, you know, intended to do as the highway was built next to the property. Then they were expanding their use. And I think you have to have some ability to expand the use concurrent with economic times and development. I don't think that you have to say, and that means you can build a hotel too. The remedy that the court fashioned for the possibility that some amount of property might be required to be dedicated was an appropriate remedy and supported by law. What the testimony was is that perhaps a very narrow strip of land constituting 58 square feet, I believe, might have to be dedicated to the county. If that happened, and that's not a certainty at all, then the trial court properly ruled that Valero would have to compensate the landlord for that amount. And I think that's an appropriate remedy to apply when you have a situation where even in the very beginning of this lease, it was contemplated that the property owner would assist with rezoning, that's section 4, and they would assist with rezoning. They'd have to get approval from the Colorado Department of Public Health, the Tri-County Health District, the Planning Commission. Had those people required certain things, certain dedications, certain easements, the contemplation was that the original landlord would have to cooperate with that. There's no reason to say that that would not carry on to subsequent landlords as well. And finally, we come to the issue of damages. We believe that the only error, and this is our cross appeal, that the court made was in the calculation of damages. She fixed the period of damages from August of 2007 up through August of 2008. And what she did is she said, well, in August of 2007, the defendant made it very clear they would not sign the necessary documents to go forward with building a permanent structure. She said, before that, you could have had a temporary structure and not going, and if you didn't have a temporary structure, you were not mitigating your damages, okay? The question, of course, is that you have the duty to mitigate damages generally, but does the law impose an obligation on a party to go forward in the threat of litigation as opposed to trying alternative dispute resolution, negotiations of various kinds, to go ahead and commit capital resources to a rebuilding project where somebody's promised you that they are going to sue you, basically. And the backside of that is the original breach happened when the landlord took the position that you can't build anything out there but a Stuckey's. You're right, at trial, they weren't going to try to convince Judge Antrim of that, because that was a ludicrous position. But they said, well, you know, we didn't really mean that all you could build was a Stuckey's, but that's what they said. And it came out in the testimony that you couldn't rebuild a Stuckey's. Nobody had the plans for a Stuckey's. You could try to assimilate the footprint, but all the building codes had changed. You'd have essentially a different building than what you could. And so the breach really began when we could have put a temporary building up there, and we were told if you do so, we'll sue you.
Well, do you have a right to put up a temporary building?
Yes, sir.
On what basis?
We already constructed, the Stuckey's had already been constructed, and that falls under paragraph 5 of the all other lawful business, and is consistent with the plurality of the
structure. So let me follow this line of thought a bit. You could have put a temporary structure on there, which I assume, without knowing, would be a manufactured frame facility of some sort.
Yes, sir.
And you could keep it there until the end of the term and revert it back to the landlord without any building on it, or with a rundown temporary structure.
That's true. That would not be as economically viable for the company, the community, the tax coffers of Lowell County.
But you think that the lease contemplates that, or that's permitted under the lease?
That's one of the permitted uses, certainly, Your Honor.
Okay.
We would urge the court to reverse the trial court in only one regard, and that is to when the damages started. We believe the damages started in March of 2006, when we could have built. We had a temporary application approved by Arapahoe County. That's part of the record. And we were told that if we did that, we would be sued. And in this day and age, the threat of litigation, the cost of litigation, is something people have to take seriously. And Judge Andrew.
Okay, so commit March of 2006 and end when? Not yet ended?
Well, we will end when we can build a permanent structure, which is something we're.
Damages will continue all the way until you build a permanent structure?
No, the damages would continue until the plaintiff signed the application for us to build a permanent structure.
That's why she
stopped the application in August of 2008. She stopped the running of judgment or damages in August of 2008. All right. Thank the court for it.
Thank you.
I'd like to start, if I may, right where things finished there, dealing with the temporary structures. I believe your question, Judge Roy, about the reversionary interest and defeating the reversionary interest simply by with respect to keeping a temporary facility on the property points to Valero's strategy here and their tactics. I mean, the reality is that they want to construe these provisions to suggest that they can do effectively any lawful purpose. And that suggests the problem with the argument that they made and the conclusion that the trial court reached. That's not what the lease says. The lease says that they can build specific facilities and improvements on this property. And then once they do that, then they can use those facilities and improvements for any lawful business purpose. That's very different than what Valero's contending to you and what the trial court found. And the problem is that we have to go back to 1967 when these parties entered into this lease. And this lease has been referred to as a 60-year lease. That's a little bit of a mischaracterization of what the lease was. It had an original term of 15 years. and three options for 15 years each. And going back to 1967, when you build a building in 1967, you look at what's the expected life of that building. And at each juncture, the tenant, Stuckey's at that time, was going to have a decision to make. Does this building still have life in it? If it doesn't, it doesn't exercise its option. If it does, it exercises the option. That's a different scenario than talking about a 60-year lease that contemplates that they're going to be able to build, rebuild, remodel, do whatever they need to do to the building. And when you look commensurate with the consideration that was being paid at the time, it's certainly more consistent to construe the lease in that vein, especially in light of the fact that it was a 15-year original term and three option periods. To suggest that somehow, because those option periods have thus far been exercised, that the parties contemplated that that would in fact be the case, would write out the option entirely. I mean, the fact of the matter is this wasn't a 60-year lease.
So let me go back to the failure to mitigate. Why didn't Valero mitigate its damages when B&D threatened litigation against it when it offered to build a temporary facility?
Well, first and foremost, let me say that I disagree with the characterization of threatening litigation. But the point is, Valero didn't seem terribly concerned about litigation because they filed this action. And so the concept or notion that they cowered and decided that they better not do that, put a temporary structure on there because this landlord said, I'll exercise my legal remedies, seems a little bit inconsistent here. Because the minute this landlord said, I won't sign these documents requiring me to undertake new obligations, Valero took him to court in a heartbeat. And so the consequence of that suggestion, it seems to me, is just pointing out a further inconsistency. The trial court specifically found that it, in a summary judgment, or in the trial judgment in July of 2008, that Valero made a tactical decision not to go on the property. And that tactical decision was to avoid its mitigation obligations, or was to, as a consequence, void its right to recover damages during the period in which it failed to mitigate. The problem with the trial court's decision is that it was talking about the March of 2006 to August of 2008 timeframe, when in fact that continued throughout the entire period. So it was inconsistent for the court to say they failed to mitigate their damages for a short period of time, but then to award them damages later. And it's our contention that to the extent damages are ever to be awarded under these circumstances, you have to take into account the fact that they didn't mitigate their damages. I mean, their concern about a temporary building didn't stop them from doing it a while back. I mean, they've got a temporary building on there now. And the consequence, it seems to the landlord, of those decisions are that they should not be able to recover their damages. A couple of other points I want to make. I believe that because you don't have some of this in front of you, it's difficult, but the plans that have been submitted to the landlord reflect a 50% larger building than the Stuckey's building that was there originally. So the suggestion that it's the same size or smaller doesn't fit with what's been submitted.
Let me ask you a question, and I don't want to take the rest of your time, but in the record is a set of plans for a building that looks very similar to a Stuckey's building. Was that ever Valero's plans?
It was initially, as I understand it, Valero's plans. When the court entered summary judgment in their favor, their plans changed.
I know, but those were the plans that were before the court at the time of summary judgment.
Those were the plans that were in front of the court at the time of summary judgment through trial. I believe that's correct. Yes. I believe my...
Is he wrong on that? That the plans in the record are other than what was existing at the time of the summary judgment and perhaps trial?
No, the plans that are in the record are the plans that were submitted to the defendant to authorize. They're part of the pre-application package that goes to Arapahoe County, and they are the plans that were being asked, that they were at that time were being asked to approve, and the court is correct as to their being very close to the original structure.
That was at the time of summary judgment and at the time of trial.
All the way through.
The plans have changed since then, or perhaps have changed, and not in the record.
There have been several revisions to the plans. I cannot speak to council's statement about the 50% increase in the present plan.
Judge Roy, if I could quickly address your question about the power of attorney, however, because if you read...
I'm afraid you can't.
Fair enough. Okay. All right. Fair enough.
We thank both parties for their briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.